Hi everyone, and welcome to Ask the Horse Live. I'm your host, Haley Peffer, digital editor at thehorse.com. Mare reproductive challenges can range from endometritis to ovarian irregularities and can disrupt normal cycles and fertility. Older mares often face anatomical complications that increase contamination and impair conception. Vigilant diagnostics are essential to identifying and managing these issues efficiently. This event is brought to you by Equithrive. To answer your questions, we are joined by expert panelists Dr. Carly Fedorka of Colorado State University and Dr. Jenna Ward from the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Very much so, thank you.
Dr. Fedorka, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I came into this reproductive field a little bit abnormally. Grew up in 4-H and did Pony Club and Evented and that whole thing. And I went to college to go to vet school and went to a small liberal arts school in upstate New York. And I actually got a degree in biology and English, but I graduated during the recession of 2008. So while most of my friends moved home to the basements of their parents' house, I moved to Lexington, Kentucky, and got employed as a groom on a thoroughbred breeding farm. And I kind of immersed myself in the breeding industry in Kentucky and loved it. Just found a huge passion for it. And interestingly enough, we had a mare abort 1 year to a disease called Nicardiaform placentitis. And I always joke that I went down to the University of Kentucky and entered Dr. Mott Strodson's office as a pretty angry farm manager, and I somehow exited his office and enrolled in graduate school. So I got a PhD under Dr. Trodson in reproductive physiology, and then I stayed at the UK Gluck Equine Research Center for a postdoctoral scholarship, which is kind of similar to a residency where I did reproductive immunology. And then just a couple years ago, I got a professorship out at Colorado State University. So that's my true passion, is reproductive immunology and how we can understand how inflammation and infectious disease might tie in with the reproductive tract.
Awesome. Thank you. And Dr. Ward, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Absolutely. So I'm a little bit less exciting than Dr. Fedorka, I have to admit, but I'll do my best to put on a little bit of a show as well. So I'm originally from California. My parents weren't really horse people or anything like that, but we were very much animal people. So I was one of the, you know, five-year-olds sitting there going, I'm going to be a vet. And then my best friend introduced me to horses at age 8, and I never looked back. So I went up to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo for my undergrad, and I got a degree in animal science. And while I was there, you know, if there's anyone who's familiar with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, the motto there is learn by doing. And despite the fact that, you know, we make fun of it a lot, it was very true. I castrated more horses in undergrad than I did in vet school. We would get taught how to do vaccines on a horse, and then they'd point to a herd of 30 and tell us don't die. And what it meant was there, I got to do ICSI, which some of you have probably heard of as an advanced reproductive technique. Now, you know, not for clients or anything like that, obviously. We were making little chimeras that weren't going to develop beyond, you know, a 4-cell stage. But regardless, I got to do it. And I said, I want to do something like this for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, I was already, you know, committed to vet school, so I did not apply for a PhD or anything like that at that time. Went out to Texas A&M for vet school, chasing down, you know, some of the best reproductive experts I could find. Went and did a brief detour doing an ambulatory internship at a tiny practice out in New York once I graduated, and then followed some of those reproductive experts right over to the University of Pennsylvania for my residency. Took a brief detour elsewhere again, also in New York. But I'm back now here as a lecturer for the next couple of years. So it's good to be back, and it's excellent to be here. So thanks so much for allowing me to be here.
Awesome. Thank you both. Before we begin answering questions, I want to remind everyone of our Ask the Horse Live format. We're starting with questions submitted during registration. If you're listening live and would like to submit a question, please do so via the chat window. We'll do our best to get to as many of your questions as possible. If you're listening to the podcast recording of this event and would like to join us live in the future, please visit thehorse.com/askthehorselive to register for notifications. With that, we're going to jump in. So our first question is for you, Dr. Fedorka. It's from Jake in Spain, who wants to know why veterinarians might have trouble getting a mare pregnant. What are the most common reasons for fertility problems?
So that's a question we get asked a lot. And the data tells us that the greatest cause of subfertility of or infertility is actually my passion project, which is the disease of what we call persistent breeding-induced endometritis, or PBIE. And this disease just means that the mare's uterus doesn't react to semen in a normal way. So they end up having inflammation for a really long time. And if that inflammation is still there in her uterus by the time the embryo gets to the uterus, roughly 6 days after she ovulates, then that embryo is going to get to a pretty unhappy uterus and probably die. We see this in about 20% of all of our mares, but it's also something that can lead to other problems like chronic infections, even pyometra. So that's definitely your number one problem that you're going to struggle with just based on numbers. But it also is kind of a co-variable to a variety of other things that are going to cause problems. So we see this disease of PBIE more so in aged mares. So your older mares are going to be harder to breed. And that's mostly because their uterus isn't as healthy as it once was. It just deteriorates over time. We also see with those aged mares that we're going to have some cervical issues. Their cervix isn't going to behave like it should either. But then more so when we start looking a little bit more broadly, keep in mind that your general herd health is going to very strongly impact your mare's ability to get pregnant. So if she's obese, if she has PPID, if she's lame, so keep those things in mind as well. But when we're talking specifically about the reproductive tract, it is endometritis or delayed uterine clearance.
And Dr. Ward, Elizabeth wants to know what diagnostic tests you use to determine if a mare is suitable to breed, and what is the ideal age to breed a mare?
So, you know, the ideal age, I think, honestly, I'll just start there because it's a slightly shorter question, despite how I'm just about to answer it, is that, you know, the ideal age to breed them kind of depends on their breeding history. If it is a maiden mare, I get very nervous if they're 12 or older, and honestly, a lot of times if they're 10 or older. I'm not saying it can't be done, but there are definitely some challenges to breeding a maiden mare. So I ideally love horses that are less than 10. You know, but if it's a mare who has been pregnant multiple times, who has carried multiple foals, you know, breeding them later on is something that is much, much more doable. They're less likely to have some of the abnormalities of like the cervix that Dr. Fedorka mentioned that we have also seen very much in these older maiden mares. Some mares, if they've been pregnant year to year, you can keep them pregnant a lot longer than you might think they could stay pregnant. So I think that's the kind of long and short of that there. But for first breeding, I would love it at least under 12. In terms of diagnostic test, again, it kind of does determine, or it's kind of based on history, but there's one kind of big procedure that we use in general to assess breeding soundness. And, you know, fantastically enough, it's the breeding soundness evaluation. So it does take into account some of the systemic things that Dr. Fedorka mentioned, looking for lameness, looking for obesity, looking for any outer conformational abnormalities, any abnormalities in her vulvar conformation, which could lead her to be more prone to endometritis or, after she gets pregnant, to placentitis. So those things are very important. Also, you know, things like her teeth, if she has trouble eating, if she has trouble maintaining her own weight, she would also have trouble maintaining the weight and the growth of her fetus. So those things we look at. We also do like a normal ultrasound, like folks do when they are breeding. We can maybe see if there are any congenital abnormalities to her uterus or her ovaries or, you know, some other part of her tract. Additionally, you know, if this is a mare with an unknown history or a history of having been bred before, but not in a while, you may be able to see signs of something like endometritis that may need treating beforehand. And then you can also take a culture in those cases to see if you can culture what bacteria might be causing that endometritis so that you can appropriately treat it. You can do a cytology, which is taking a brush kind of swab to scrape up some cells of the uterus, and you can look at that under the microscope and see if you're seeing a lot of like white blood cells that indicate that inflammation. And then finally, you can take a biopsy. So you just kind of take a pinch of tissue out of the uterus and you look at it under, also under a microscope, and you can see invasion of white blood cells. You can see fibrosis, which can be a major cause of kind of delayed fluid clearance and is something that is seen a lot in those older mares. and see how many glands, if they're nested, you know, see, again, kind of assessing the general health of her uterus. So all of those decisions together, or all of those diagnostics together, plus a history, can give us an idea of how likely it is that she can carry a pregnancy to term, and how worth it is to breed her, or, you know, if there may be some other techniques that we may want to use to get a foal out of her.
Dr. Fedorka, Ethelyn in North Carolina asks what qualities you look for in a recipient mare, and could you first explain what that is for those that might not know?
For sure. So a recipient mare, with all intents and purposes, is what we call a surrogate. So they are mares that we actually utilize to carry the pregnancy from a donor mare that we're going to flush an embryo out of, usually day 7 or day 8 after we've bred her and she's ovulated. And then we're going to take that day 8 embryo and put it into a surrogate, into a recipient mare. We also use them when we perform things like ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or what is now becoming commercially available, which is IVF. So in that case, we're taking an embryo from a petri dish and putting it into a recipient mare. So I would love to tell you all of the amazing things we should check for in a recipient mare, but I'm going to start with the caveat that we tend to have a shortage of recipient mares in the United States. So although I would love to list the 10 things, and I will, of what you should look for, keep in mind that due to this shortage, a lot of these things are either being overlooked or slightly ignored. So we were always trained that a recipient mare should be younger, because going back to what Dr. Ward and I have been saying, that older uterus just isn't as healthy. So we want them to be younger, but we also want them to have shown that they can carry a pregnancy. So we don't want them to be natives. We want them to have carried at least one foal. And even though we want them to be younger, we also want them to be manageable. So we want them to be halter broke. We want to be able to catch them, because theoretically that mare is not just carrying that foal, but she's also going to nurse that foal and imprint it for the first 6 months until you wean it. So they need to have the same assets that we think of with a normal breeding mare. We want them to be sound, good-footed, not need crazy podiatry, not need to live on Equiox, but they also need to be relatively broke and gentle to handlers. And like I said, with all of those things listed above, in the current day and age, we tend to not really be getting those recipient mares. So if you're looking out in your field in your backyard right now and going, oh my gosh, why did, you know, Texas A&M or UC Davis send me home with this recent mare that I can't catch? That's most likely why, because there's a massive shortage of them.
Yeah, I will note that over in our herd, we have a very small herd at UPenn, but we most of ours are handleable. There are one or two that you could make the argument or not. But with ours, it's maidens. That's where we tend to lose our thing, where we'll take maidens any day, just because we'd lose a significant amount of our herd if we didn't. Luckily, it hasn't bit us in the butt too much, but it is very, you'd think every maiden would take, but they very definitely do not. So it's nice to have a proven track record.
For sure.
Awesome, thank you. Dr. Ward, Logan in Kentucky wants to know how veterinarians treat endometritis in mares. He's seen many options and wants to know the pros and cons of each.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one where I will absolutely from the beginning invite Dr. Fedorka to step in with her area of expertise if I say anything that she is like, hey, no, or if she has anything to add at the end, which I suspect you probably will. But I'll just kind of speak from my experience and what we tend to do here. So the one thing I will say is there's kind of one bit where it changes my thoughts on how I treat, in that Dr. Fedorka spoke of the persistent breeding-induced endometritis. The key there is persistent, and that's the hard stuff to deal with, but every single mare that you will breed will have a breeding-induced endometritis. So what we have found there, the best things to work with for a mare who's having a more exuberant reaction, is we check our mares 4 hours after breeding. I know that's not always feasible in like an ambulatory situation. So when we're doing field calls, you know, we will check them the next day for the first time. But 4 hours is the kind of earliest they have found that you can lavage a mare's uterus and not reduce the risk of, not reduce pregnancy rates. So at 4 hours, we check so that we can get an early start on that inflammatory cascade before it really, really, really goes haywire and you're really, really fighting it. So at that time, if we have a mare who has a lot of fluid or who has fluid that shows up as kind of gray echogenic on the ultrasound, or her edema has gone up from when we last checked her, then we're going to go in and we will lavage her uterus to get that inflammatory fluid out of there. And we'll also give her some sort of anti-inflammatory. So our frozen mares get dexamethasone, a steroid, at the time of breeding. So we won't give them anything until the next day, because that lasts 24 hours. And then we typically put them on Equiox. So we'll give them 3 tablets as a loading dose that day. And then we do a full 5-day course where it's just once a day after that. And we have found that to be very, very successful in our mares, that they don't have this persistent breeding-induced endometritis, but they just need a little bit of help clearing that inflammatory cascade. Now, the endometritis before breeding, the mainstay for us kind of treatment is really just culture and then treat based on the susceptibility, the antibiotic susceptibility that was shown on that culture, just so that we can be good antibiotic stewards and make sure that we're using the appropriate antibiotics to treat the appropriate organisms. And the other thing that we have found very helpful here, and I believe this is all is actually taken from some folks at CSU, is there are things called, or that we just call, biofilm busters. So some bacteria, especially like E. coli, which is one of our most common pathogens, they like to make this biofilm that really protects it, sometimes even from being picked up on a culture. And it protects the bacteria from the actual antibiotics. So you can treat these horses over and over again, and they either don't clear up, or they clear up and then almost immediately become reinfected. So in those cases, we use a biofilm buster that is effective on that species and with the antibiotic we're using, which typically means that we're using hydrogen peroxide at an appropriate dilute level. And when we put that in there with our antibiotic infusions for at least usually like 3 days before we breed, if we're breeding on the same cycle, then we have fairly, fairly good success with that. Now, some mares are a little bit more resistant. We struggle to either identify the pathogen or get them to go away. There are kits that you can send out for a PCR that can tell you exactly what's in there, and you can try and tailor your treatment appropriately. There have been some studies on putting platelet-rich plasma in the uterus and seeing if it improves pregnancy rates. We did it as an N of one and it did not work, but again, N of one. I don't know if Dr. Fedorka has had any experience with that, but our main experience is you lavage, you keep the gross things out, and you put antibiotics that are shown to work against your cultured bacteria, and you add a biofilm buster in there. And we have fairly, fairly good success with that.
Yeah, and the only couple of things I'll add mm-hmm. here, and this is my passion, so I could talk about this for an hour.
Oh,
and
that's fine.
Not to.
You go for it.
I feel like the only thing that you have truly forgotten, and I know it was just as a forgetful thing because I guarantee you do it, mm-hmm. is that we always tell people to add an ecbolic. So make sure that you're getting these mares oxytocin. at that 4-hour time point, and then every 6 hours for a couple of days. The one thing I always try to really reiterate to people is that if your mare is truly susceptible to this disease, anything that you put into her uterus is going to reignite that inflammation. So to Dr. Ward's point about the infectious endometritis that she's seeing before she breeds them, that doesn't always mean that the mare is susceptible to PBIE, because any mare can get an infection. Just bad luck, right? So in those cases, heck yeah, get a culture, get a cytology, get those mares treated. But once you've bred that mare, you have to be a little bit careful of putting more stuff in her uterus. So it actually made me happy to hear you say that you guys did Dex at time of breeding, and then you added the Equiox after breeding, because that's what we have been trying to promote for years now, is that these mares lack anti-inflammatory signals. Like, that is why their immune system is screwed up. So basically, at about 6 hours after breeding, you have to help them with some anti-inflammatory signaling. And then to Dr. Ward's point, there's probably 100 different options that you can choose from. And I always tell people that although my career is kind of made developing more of those options, the diagnostics are the key. So really knowing what's causing this endometritis, and then selecting a treatment option based on that, because you could throw all the anti-inflammatories in the world at a mare, but if her cervix has a massive hole in it, or her perineum is massively tilted and you haven't put a Caslix in, you're fighting an uphill battle. So really doing a thorough breeding soundness exam and then selecting your targeted treatment based on that.
Dr. Fedorka, Betsy in our live audience asks, are there any signs of hormonal tumors which manifest as erratic behavior or cycle abnormality?
For sure. And I always joke that, you know, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, and let's not go hunting for coyotes. So if your mare is acting erratically and more specifically aggressively, it is usually caused by what we call a granulosa fecal cell tumor. And that is a tumor that develops on the ovary. And what it does is, instead of the ovary producing estrogen and progesterone like it should for a mare, it starts producing testosterone, anti-Müllerian hormone, and inhibin. And the first thing you want to do is have your vet out to ultrasound that mare, because usually you can actually visualize those tumors, but we're now diagnosing them earlier and earlier, so they don't always come up on ultrasound. And the gold standard diagnostic is just a simple blood test that you send to UC Davis, and you have them run those three hormones. You have them look at testosterone, AMH, and inhibin. And if they're elevated, there's a good chance that your mare has a GCT.
Awesome. Dr. Fedorka, Mariana in Ukraine asks how veterinarians can distinguish between a mare not getting pregnant due to a reaction to the semen extender versus a reaction to the semen itself.
So this question comes up a lot, and it goes back to how we've been talking about endometritis. So the thing that we have to remember is that the immune response to breeding that we talk about with endometritis, it happens in every mare, and it's just kind of an erratic inflammation. It'd be the exact same thing as you getting stung by a bee, right? You put a foreign particle into the uterus, and the immune system detects it as foreign and comes in to kill it and get rid of it. And we hear a lot when mares are bred with frozen semen that they have a lot of inflammation where they normally didn't if they were bred with live cover or cooled semen. And immediately the breeder and the veterinarian blame it on the extender. Well, I'm here to burst everybody's bubble. The mare's uterus doesn't actually have allergy type receptors. So it's not an allergic response to extender. And what it actually is that when we prepare semen to be frozen, we actually centrifuge off the liquid portion. And that liquid portion is called seminal plasma. And seminal plasma was put on this planet to help that immune response to breeding. It actually has really important proteins in it that tell the mare's body, hey, kill this sperm. Don't kill this sperm. Help out with this. Let's get rid of the fluid. And so every time that we breed a mare with frozen or cooled shift that was centrifuged, we've removed that seminal plasma and we've added back extender. And all that's doing is really not helping our mares with that immune response. So keep that in mind. And with those mares that really, really, really blow with fluid, if you're breeding them with frozen, that might be a mare that you want to lean more towards a stallion that either will let you do fresh semen or cooled shift that's not having the seminal plasma centrifuged down.
Dr. Ward, Toby in Florida asks, what follicle size is best when breeding a mare?
Well, so there's an easy answer and there's the slightly more nuanced answer. So the answer you'll hear us say is a 35 millimeter follicle is what we need. But really kind of that's for our purposes, because that is what we need for our ovulatory drugs to work so that we can make sure that our timing is appropriate. Now, technically, with one of them, it can be a little bit smaller as long as she's had good edema. But 35 is kind of, you know, that's what we drill in our students' head is on a 35, you can give the ovulatory drug and then you can make your plans. However, the decision on what follicle size you actually give the ovulatory agent on, whether it's a 35 or a 40 or a 43, is mostly based on the mare. you know, we don't want to miss her. So if her follicle has gotten large and then it's not really growing anymore, we're going to worry that she's going to ovulate on her own. So we might kind of panic, give her the ovulatory agent so we can control it. But the main thing is we want to see good edema in the mare. And some mares don't develop really good uterine edema. Well, some don't develop it at all. But some of them don't develop it until their follicles are quite large, or unless they have multiple larger follicles at the same time. And pregnancy rates go up when you have at least 2 days of good edema. So we, at least over at Penn, we really, really, really try to hold off until we have at least 2 good days of excellent edema. Again, sometimes the world doesn't behave the way that we want it to. But I would say 35 is kind of our minimum, and we usually end up inducing ovulation, I'd say anywhere between 35 and 40, which are all great. So that's the nuanced answer.
Awesome. Thank you. Dr. Fedorka, Michael in Colorado asked if there are any supplements he should give his mare prior to breeding her, and are there any diet changes he should make?
So I'll answer the second question first, which is, like I said earlier, we really don't want our mares to be obese. That's easier said than done. Coming from Kentucky and moving to Colorado, I'm seeing a ton more obesity in this quarter horse population than I was ever seeing in the thoroughbred population in Kentucky. So we've always said that as you enter breeding season, you actually want your mare to be on an increasing plan of nutrition. You don't want to get into breeding season and suddenly panic when the grass kicks in and want to muzzle them and stress them out. So really currently at this time of the year, start making those diet changes. Start really getting those mares a little bit lighter, obviously not thin, but we want them on a BCS of 4.5. So we don't want them at a 6 or a 7. To answer the first question, this is actually something I'm studying right now, but the quick and dirty answer is that the only supplement that is on the market that has any data to help with reproduction at the moment is L-carnitine. And L-carnitine was shown in a study by CSU to actually improve ovarian health. So it was more so being used from an ICSI point of view, and you were able to see that when you supplemented mares with L-carnitine, that their oocyte quality improved. We just completed a study this summer where we looked at another, what we call biologic, and this was resveratrol. So resveratrol is what comes out of grapes that makes French people not have heart attacks. Basically, it's the reason that doctors tell you that it's okay to have a glass of red wine a day, and it actually might make you healthier. And that is because resveratrol is a really good anti-inflammatory and antioxidant. So, you know, the topic of today has been endometritis and how these mares lack anti-inflammatory signaling. So we did a study this summer where we fed mares resveratrol that had PBIE. So these were screwed up mares. You were not going to get them pregnant. And then we bred them and monitored their inflammation. And we actually got some cool data. So we saw resveratrol decrease the number of white blood cells that was in the uterus. We also saw that it decreased the inflammatory cytokines that were in the uterus. And we're still analyzing a ton of data, but it's pretty convincing to me that it's working in some way, shape, or form as an anti-inflammatory. And I always tell people, you know, that's great, that the science makes sense, but definitely the next step would be to see if we could actually improve fertility in these mares that are so subfertile. So that's kind of what I envision for next year. That is not published yet. We should hopefully have the data done, I'm assuming mid-October, and that's something that we'll probably submit to one of the veterinary conferences like AAEP or SFT and get published and out to the masses next year.
Awesome, thank you. Dr. Ward, Cindy in Wisconsin wants to know if and how age can affect the likelihood of a safe pregnancy and delivery in horses.
Yes, so it can. You know, we talk a lot, we've already spoken briefly about it before, and I think it's coming up in the discussion a little bit later as well, how hard it can be to get these mares pregnant, but their delivery is something that also concerns me, in especially the older maiden mares. You know, if it's an older mare who has had pregnancies before, I have far less concern, especially if her most recent foal has been within the past year or two. But when a mare has never had a foal, you know, their cervix, the cervix is what protects the uterus. It's what keeps things out. It's what keeps the baby safely in and protected when, you know, she's pregnant. And it can get quite tight. It feels like a pencil sometimes. It is so tight. And it relaxes a little bit during each estrus cycle, but nothing like what it has to relax to get a baby out. So if a mare has not undergone that experience before, when she is older, their cervixes tend to be a little bit more, less inclined to open, which can cause dystocias when they actually do end up going to full, because we get a lot of issues where their cervixes don't fully dilate. And if their cervix doesn't fully dilate, I can't get a baby out that way, not safely. A lot of times the baby just won't go. And if the baby does go, it might just obliterate her cervix, which if she's supposed to be a broodmare, then that would, you know, be impossible really for her to have her job most likely, if the tear is quite severe. And, you know, C-sections are quite expensive. So I know it's, you know, less than ideal. Additionally, there have been some studies, I believe, that older, again, maiden mares, not mares who have had foals before, do kind of struggle with one of the major cause, or one of a unfortunately reasonably common complication of pregnancy, of late term pregnancy, is or right near birth, is a middle uterine artery rupture. And it's from the stress of the stretch of the baby on the broad ligament, which is the, you know, the ligamentous supportive tissue around the uterus and the oviducts and the ovaries. And there are studies that in these maiden mares where that stretch hasn't happened before, they're susceptible to more irregularities there and a higher likelihood of that rupturing or having a small bleed, which could be, you know, they can get through it, or it can be sudden death. It's a very, very scary thing when it happens. So, and then beyond just the normal, you know, older mares typically have, you know, they might have arthritis, they might have lameness issues. And anytime, you know, babies are heavy, the fetal membranes and the fluid in there is also heavy. So adding any more weight to them can be, you know, detrimental to their quality of life. So that's something that I always think of with older mares and older maiden mares in particular.
Awesome. Thank you. Dr. Fedorka, Susan in Connecticut says her older mare is still showing behavior problems while on Altrigenist. Can you explain why this could be happening? And what should her next steps be to investigate the problem?
Yeah, so that's a multi-answerable question. I think one of the things that we always have to make sure of is that the behavioral problem that we put the mare on Altrigenist for is truly because of her ovaries. It always cracks me up. I am not a mare person. I fully admit that. I own geldings and only geldings. But I also acknowledge the fact that if you don't like mare-like behavior, then maybe a mare isn't for you. But it seems to be a consistent question that we get. And I always tell people that just like a human who's maybe trying to get pregnant, start tracking your mare cycle. Mares should cycle roughly every 21 days. And more importantly, they should only really cycle from the middle of April until the middle of September, as long as you live kind of in the same equatorial region as Lexington, Kentucky, or Fort Collins, Colorado, or New Bolton, Pennsylvania. So keeping in mind that they're seasonal and their estrus cycle lasts every 21 days. So if your mare is having behavioral problems in January, it's probably not because of her ovaries. If your mare is having behavioral problems every 3 days, it's probably not because of her ovaries. Now, say you've ruled out everything else, and she truly is having behavioral problems every 21 days, only in the summertime, you put her on Regimate, and it doesn't fix anything. Well, first and foremost, Regimate's not foolproof, right? Even in the study that Ed Squires did in the 90s, where they looked at 500 mares, it only suppressed estrus in 89%. So keep that in mind, that your mare could be of that 11% that just doesn't respond to it. And then the other thing to think of is, what behavior is she showing that's bothering you? Because that goes back to the granulocytica cell tumor that I just mentioned that could be on her ovary. That will not be suppressed by Regimate, by Altrigenist. So if your mare has aggressive behavior that's not happening every 21 days and Regimate does not block it, then that would be one of the diagnostics I would reach for, which is running that testosterone inhibin and anti-malarian hormone in her circulatory system. So just taking a blood test and shipping it off.
I would also add, if you do not mind terribly, just some of the stuff that we've seen commonly that kind of is quote unquote the problem rather than ovaries, because we also see a lot of these kind of similar cases, is I would have the horse very, very thoroughly worked up for lameness. You would be surprised, especially, or just orthopedic problems in general. Back and hip pain, pelvis pain has been something that we've seen with these guys before. Gastric ulcers can be a big one. And then the one that I always think of, because a lot of times they're like, well, it has to be her ovaries. Like, she's squatting and she's winking and she's squirting and she's got this scalding on her legs. Obviously, that's the issue. Well, sometimes they just have issues with their bladder. They could have bladder stones. They could be urine pooling and it could be making them very uncomfortable. And some of those signs that we think of as classic estrus signs are also classic for those sorts of problems as well. So I just always recommend people look at those things as well. And just would also like to very, very much second Dr. Fedorka's comment on track the mare's cycle, because you would be, it helps a lot. It helps a lot in narrowing down what may be going on. So.
Yeah. And if I can add back to that, another passion project. The other thing that I get asked all the time is, you're right, she's not cycling every 21 days. She's cycling every 14 or 15, or she's having behavioral problems every 14 or 15. And to your point, exactly what you described, she's breaking down, she's winking, she's behaving, you know, like a hussy. And going back to my passion of immunology, we have to remember that the very signal that tells our mare to come into heat, it's called prostaglandin F2 alpha. It basically says, hey, your uterus isn't pregnant, let's get you back into estrus. That prostaglandin F2 alpha, PGF2 alpha, that's the very drug that we reach for when we reach for luteolyse or estromate. So it's how we short cycle mares to get them into heat. And anytime that you have infection or inflammation, it also releases PGF2 alpha. So before you ever put your mare on regimate, you really want to have your veterinarian out to check her and make sure that she doesn't have a uterine infection that is potentially short cycling her back into heat quickly over and over and over. Because the one real risk of regimate, and it's on the very back of the bottle, if you don't believe me, is that regimate itself is actually pro-inflammatory. So it says on the back of the bottle that this drug will turn a low-grade inflammation into a fulminating infection. And it does so for a variety of reasons. A, it screws up the immune system, but B, it also shuts down the cervix. So it really gives whatever's in that uterus nowhere to go, and then kind of lights a match under the inflammation. So if your mare, when you make that cycle map, if you see that your mare is having behavioral problems every 12 to 18 days, that is a sure sign that you need your vet to come out and check that mare out.
Awesome. Thank you both. Dr. Ward, Leslie in Texas wants to know if it's safe to sedate a pregnant mare for certain procedures such as radiographs or dental exams.
Yes, we absolutely sedate our pregnant mares for lots of things, including those things. The only thing, this is just, again, from a reproductive perspective, or if any other vets sedate things for bringing in for a pregnancy evaluation, in late-term pregnant mares, I would avoid acepromazine, not really for any particular horrible effects on the mare, but more in that it kind of turns everything into mush back there, and making an assessment of what is going on with a late-term pregnant mare, if you have any concerns about like placentitis or fetal health or something like that, it can be very challenging to actually assess anything back there. So that's just Dr. Ward's two cents on, please don't use isoprenazine. You will thank me when you go try and look at a pregnant mare in late gestation.
Dr. Fedorka, Barton in Georgia says he recently purchased a mare that he believes could be in foal. What should his next steps be?
Well, that's a kind of hard one to answer because it really depends on what stage of pregnancy she's in. So if she is 70, maybe even 85 days or less, It's as simple as having your vet come out, palpate, ultrasound, look for an embryo, or I should say then a developing fetus. And if she's at the tail end of pregnancy, it's the exact same thing. So anytime after 175 or 200 days, it's really, really, really easy to scan these mares. Now that in-between phase, if you don't have a skilled veterinarian, you don't have a board certified theriogenologist, that can be a little bit trickier because the fetal placental unit can actually fall over that pelvic brim and it can be a little hard to actually monitor that. Now, the simple solution is you can do transabdominal scans, but again, if your practitioner is not that skilled, transabdominal is not going to be something they're reaching for. So you always run the risk of having kind of a period where a lot of lesser skilled practitioners will call a mare not pregnant and they might be pregnant. So keep that in mind. During that time period, during kind of middle gestation, we can pull blood for total estrogens, because they will be much more high during a pregnancy than they would be during the estrus cycle. But again, you can have false negatives if your mare isn't at that gestational length. So there's unfortunately not a simple blood test. There is one that we can use in conjunction with other information. But first and foremost, it is getting a skilled veterinarian out there to do a thorough examination of her uterus.
Dr. Ward, Luis in Mexico wants to know if misoprostol could help a mare with a closed cervix. If so, what is the best administration protocol?
So yes, that's a very interesting question. So the answer is maybe, kind of, sort of, which essentially, so they have done a study using misoprostol gel. They used 1 milligram slathered over the cervix to see if it would assist in opening the cervix during estrus. And they found that it did not appear to help. There was no statistically significant improvement in cervical dilation. However, there has been a case study where they applied the same amount for dilation, to assist in dilation for an abortion. And what's one thing that is very interesting about that is in the study, it was a compounded gel. And then on the second one, it was actually the pills dissolved in sterile water and some lube and manually massaged over the cervix. And they reported success in that, having them open the cervix for delivery of this aborted fetus, which is very, very helpful because, you know, like I mentioned with the older mares before, when you're having to abort a 7-8 month fetus because it died and the mare just isn't, you know, pushing it out on her own, when you initiate some of those protocols to help her get it out, like, you know, administering oxytocin, something to help her squeeze it, you run the risk of them not dilating their cervix all the way. And then you end up again in the same situation where you're in a C-section potentially for an abortion, which clients won't always go for. All that being said, I don't know a ton of folks who have done it. I think one of my friends may have done it once, and we have tried it exactly once here. And for our experience, we will never do it again, because the fun thing about misoprostol is it does have a risk, even in the other place where we really use it a lot in mares, which is trying to clear up oviducts, because sometimes they can get blocked, and this can be a reason mares aren't getting pregnant. There isn't a risk of an acute anaphylactic reaction, and the mare can go into shock. And unfortunately for us, our mare did go into anaphylactic shock the second we put that, within about 5 minutes of us putting that misoprostol on her cervix. Now, thankfully, it was a happy ending, and it did end up saving her life, because these owners were going to do a terminal C-section on her, and something about the panic, they decided they wanted to do a real C-section instead. And we got both her and her baby out alive, which is great. But it definitely made us shy away from it a little bit. And I haven't seen much talk of it beyond that one case study where it was successful. So I would say technically yes, but I would advise caution.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, I'm not a co-author on the paper that said that it doesn't work, but it was one of the first projects I assisted on in graduate school at Gluck. I think that paper, the lead author is Justin McNaughton.
Yes.
And in our experience, like, the data says it didn't do anything. So
yeah,
formulations matter, but in a decent size of animals, it didn't help at all.
Yes, And I would say, you know, to be fair, we did not check this mare's cervix to see if it actually dilated. She went right on the table. So I can't speak to whether it did that job, regardless of the outcome. But yeah, I am more inclined, again, with the formulation to, I would side with y'all for sure on that research.
Dr. Fedorka, Carol in California is interested in breeding her 19-year-old mare for the first time. Are there any special considerations for breeding the senior horse for the first time?
Yeah, I think we've gone over the majority of them already in discussion, and I guess I might get a little bit feisty with this question, which I might regret later, but I always tell my friends that call me with this exact question of, do you really like your mare? Because I think that once you've been in this industry for long enough, and there's always a risk, right? There's always a risk anytime we do any procedure on these animals, but you start to add incremental percentages of risk with each variable. So your maiden mare, there's an increased risk. Your aged maiden mare, there's an increased risk. They're going to carry it themselves, increased risk. And, you know, I come from thoroughbred land, so I never really got to say these things before, but now that I'm in assisted reproductive technique land, if you're breeding a breed that allows for embryo transfer, let the recipient mare take that risk. You're still going to run the risk of spending a ton of money to get that embryo because you're still going to have an uphill battle dealing with her age, dealing with her cervix potentially being fibrous shut, dealing with that delayed uterine clearance. But if you truly, truly, truly love Fluffy, don't put her at that risk. The other thing to keep in mind is this a 19-year-old mare that's been actively performing? She's in beautiful health. She's jumping a meter 25. And then suddenly you decide, oh, she's 19. She's close to retirement. Let's breed her. That mare might be slightly less problematic than the mare that retired from her career when she was 8, sat in a field, got arthritic, got fat, got fluffy, et cetera. So keeping that in mind. And then a new passion project of mine is actually PPID. And we're finding out more and more that this disease, which correlates with age, we're seeing it in super high percentages of our aged populations, it's also going to impact the reproductive system. So you're not going to have a single kind of smoking gun to identify and help your mare out with. And then it's just, you know, if you're still adamant that you breed her, have it in the back of your mind that this is probably going to be a high maintenance breeding. And when your veterinarian quotes you $1,000 plus the stud fee, that's probably not accurate. So those are going to be multiple cycles, probably more treatments, probably crazier treatments. And again, that's not always, but there's a higher risk of you having to have a bit more of an expensive procedure.
Dr. Ward, Nicole in Ontario wants to know if extreme weather events can impact fetal development, and if so, what can owners do to reduce this risk?
Yeah, so from my experience, research, kind of looking up, talking around, you know, it's not necessarily the fetal development that it impacts in terms of you'll have stunted growth, you'll have, you know, XYZ. What I do worry about in these cases is pregnancy loss because of that acute stress. Like Dr. Fedorka was talking about, stress causes the release of that prostaglandin F2-alpha. And if the mare is at a stage in her cycle where she's really relying on the structures that are formed after ovulation called a corpus luteum, those are what respond to prostaglandin F2-alpha. And if her placenta isn't far enough along where it's producing enough progesterone to help her out and to keep that, maintain that pregnancy, then I would very much worry that we're going to lose that pregnancy. So, you know, in terms of reducing the risk, I think the main thing I think of is just making sure that the mares are in an environment that is as safe as you can be. Make sure if they live outside that they have sheds to go in and get out of extreme weather, that they have room to, you know, run if something is falling into pastures because of high winds. If there's a situation where it's something involving hot weather, you know, very high temperatures, we do see increased risk of early embryonic loss in horses. You know, see if you can have a run-in with electricity, with some fans, you know, some place where they can escape to something to kind of offset the stress. Unfortunately, a lot of these extreme weather events, I mean, they come out of nowhere, right? It's, you know, you can prepare for a heat wave. You can't always prepare for a tornado, you know? So that's kind of that caveat there. But I think just making their environment as safe as possible and giving them places to go when they feel unsafe is the best that I can think of to offset that.
And if I can add to that, I think you hit the nail on the head with saying that the excess heat is actually more dangerous than excess cold, and that tends to get ignored, especially out here where the bears kind of live out 24/7. So having some access to some shade is super important to your pregnant mare. The other thing, and trust me, my little sport horse soul shivers every time I saw my husband's brood mares, but I think that it can be a human-made problem. And a lot of the time we see that in those super cold spells by mares getting A, locked inside, and B, put under a blanket. And what people don't tend to think of looking into the future is that that blanket can't really stay on while a foal is nursing. Those leg straps are going to make it really hard for that foal to suckle properly. So you're blanketing a mare at the end of her pregnancy and then having to remove it when it's still probably wintertime. And that's a little barbaric and mean. And the other thing is, just like humans, mares need to move, probably more so than humans. So we can actually increase our risk of dystocia by locking mares into stalls during those severe weather threats in the wintertime.
Dr. Fedorka, Tassie in Texas asks, what causes a mare to have a drop in progesterone levels, and what do veterinarians do to treat this?
This is a trick question. First and foremost, the simple answer is that it's that pesky hormone that we keep talking about, which is prostaglandin F2-alpha. So prostaglandin F2-alpha actually kills the cells on the ovary that produce progesterone. They're called the luteal cells. And so anytime that you have inflammation or stress, or what's naturally supposed to happen on day 14 of the estrous cycle, you're going to see a drop in progesterone. Now, I will stand on a pedestal and tell everybody listening that there is no such thing as a number with which it will tell you if the mare has enough progesterone. And if we were to pick a number, it would be 1 nanogram per mil. Because 1 nanogram per mil says that those luteal cells are producing progesterone. Many laboratories are going to tell you 4. Some are going to tell you 3. I was just told that a very, very large practice is now saying 8 nanograms per mil as the cutoff. There is no good data to support anything saying that if you tested your mare one day and it was 6, and the next day that it's 3, that you're going to lose that pregnancy. And that study was really elegantly done in Canada by Dr. Bredderidge. And he basically said it's a smorgasbord. One of the mares that had decreasing progesterone slipped her pregnancy. Another mare that had decreasing progesterone was totally fine. So it's really not the best predictor of pregnancy success. And it's probably one of my top 5 pet peeves.
Dr. Ward, Edith in New Mexico has a mare with PPID that she has struggled to get in foal. Could metabolic problems affect the mare's fertility? And if so, what can she do to combat this? The mare has had foals in the past.
So I know we've hit on this a little bit, and Dr. Fedorka is definitely the expert over this, but you know, I will answer the way I was always planning on answering, which is yes, absolutely. We have absolutely struggled with mares with PPID getting them pregnant. Absolutely struggled with horses with metabolic pregnant problems getting pregnant. We actually, interestingly, we have a metabolic lab focusing on PPID, EMS, laminitis, all those fun things at New Bolton Center. And I just so happen to live with one of their fellows. And they are doing a lot of studies on our mares here, our teaching mares, and our embryo transfer mares, because many, many of them are metabolic. I think almost all of them have equine metabolic syndrome, and many of them have PPID, and some of them, because of cost, just they weren't being treated, and suddenly our mares that were semi-fertile or infertile are becoming fertile now that they are being treated for their PPID. And this is something that we've absolutely seen in our client horses as well, So the main thing that we would do, and again, Dr. Fedorka can step in and be like, hey, nope, we would do this instead, is typically if we had a mare that was cycling irregularly, that was giving us a lot of, oh my goodness, hemorrhagic anovulatory follicles or just persistent anovulatory follicles, we would test her for PPID. And then if she was positive for that, we would tell them to get her on Pergolide. And then we would wait at least 3 months before trying again, which usually meant waiting until the next season and making sure that her PPID was controlled. So not just, oh, she's on a tab, it's fine. But we have rechecked and we know that she is controlled on that dose. So that is what we would do. That is what would help and combat this for this mare. So I open it to Dr. Fedorka if she would like to add anything, because I'm sure she has a lot more things to say than I do.
No, this is just like my new thing that I have fallen down a rabbit hole of. We at CSU at the Equine Reproduction Laboratory would do exactly what you just said. It's, you know, there's actually not good data to say that PPID leads to anovulatory follicles, but it's kind of been the anecdote that every clinician has noticed. So these mares that have repeat ovulatory failure, we will do what's called a TRH stimulating test and check their levels of ACTH. Now, I will fill you guys in on a secret, because we just submitted this manuscript and hopefully it's published soon, but we actually accidentally did a PPID study where we looked at their uterus, and the cool thing, well, not cool for the PPID mare, but it really kind of clarified what we're seeing. So PPID is going to cause increased cortisol, increased ACTH, and it's caused by a tumor on the brain. And we know that these PPID animals live in like a persistent state of inflammation. And we checked that uterus and saw that the exact same inflammatory markers that are noted circulating are also elevated in the uterus. And we actually saw an increase in those white blood cells in the diestrous uterus, which is pretty scary. And maybe the coolest part was that we saw that there's almost a linear relationship between the level or the amount of ACTH that they had after we stimulated them and how many neutrophils were found in their uterus. So basically, the more severe your PPID mare is, the more likely they are to have PBIE, or that endometritis. The only thing I will argue without data, and again, this is me just being obnoxious, Pergolide is an amazing drug, but we know that it suppresses prolactin. Mm-hmm. So I am very nervous about giving it, taking it away, giving it, taking it away. And I have spoken to multiple theriogenologists that are like, you're crazy. The mares are totally fine on it. We see them lactating normally. And I am just a little bit more skeptical and do wonder if we can potentially develop a drug that is better for our reproductive PPID population. And again, I don't know what that drug is. I'm going to need about $1 million to figure it out.
Yeah, Vanessa is trying to work on it.
Oh, well, we need to talk, because I'm excited. but yeah, it scares me a little bit that the gold standard treatment for this disease potentially harms lactation.
Yeah, and I will say here, you know, we have probably, I mean, we don't see as many just pregnancies and births here at New Bolton than we used to. Because we don't have a healthy mare foaling program anymore. But with our high-risk pregnancies, we do see some mares with PPID come in and that are pregnant and that are on Pergolide. And they were given directives to take the mare off of Pergolide a month before the 340 due date. And I would say it's maybe half and half for mares that do just come into normal lactation and everything goes fine. Now, do I know the effects on how it impacts her PPID to be yanked on and off, even if it's only for like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it does for her for that. But, you know, we have just the same amount of population, I'd say, that really do struggle coming back into milk and don't. And some of them don't even really respond that well to domperidone after, which is what does concern me. They're not listening to our stimulatory signal. I mean, that says something, you know. We've started using, what else have they been using out here? I just know Van Eff's lab is doing all the things. So hopefully we may have something. I know they had a drug that they were hopeful about that didn't work out all too well, but they're always on their eye for something else. So I'm hoping if anyone finds it, I swear it's probably going to be them. So My fingers.
Yeah, I need to talk to them. I've always theorized that it's a chicken or the egg, because mm-hmm. is it ACTH that's leading to increased inflammation, or is it inflammation of the pituitary that's leading to increased ACTH? And could you actually knock it out upstream with something as simple as, say, Equiox?
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting.
Dr. Fedorka, our last question of the night is for you, and it's from Jim in Pennsylvania, who wants to know if certain breeds of horses are more prone to dystocia or difficulties foaling. What other factors could increase a horse's dystocia rate?
The simple answer to that is Friesians. If you want to put money on a breed having a problem reproductively, the answer is Friesians. And we shouldn't laugh. We really shouldn't. But
it's hard. We only laugh because it's very true. It's unfortunate, and it's so true.
Yeah, you can't get them pregnant. You can't keep them pregnant. And if you do keep them pregnant, they have problems at parturition. So that is the simple answer. I personally have not seen a convincing enough study to really look at the impact of breed. What I will do is maybe toss this back to Dr. Ward, although Dr. Sue McDonald is a good friend of mine, so I can give her the shout out as well.
Yes.
She did some really fascinating work with her feral pony herd probably 20 or 25 years ago. And what she saw was that this feral pony herd did not have dystocias. And what she noticed behaviorally is that when the mare felt, well, this is all obviously me anthropomorphizing, but take it with some grain of salt. When the mare felt that her fetus was not in the proper position, she moved around. She went for a trot. She went up a hill. She rolled down the hill. She laid down on her left side. She laid down on her right side. She went for a gallop. And they put odometers on them, basically, and saw that these mares actively moved in that first stage of labor to get that fetus correctly positioned. We do the opposite as humans. The more valuable the mare, the more likely we are to lock them in a stall, at least during nighttime. And, you know, I now in Colorado, even if they have a run, that run is not big enough. It's also flat, and these animals need access to hills and herds. So, you know, I used to say this, my husband was a broodmare manager for 20 years, and I would remind him of this study over and over and over. And he was like, yeah, good luck convincing any of us to foal outside. It's just not going to happen. The mares are worth seven figures. It's cold out. There's snow on the ground. But truly, that is the only science that we have that could help fix dystocias.
Yeah, absolutely. I joke that even my first introduction to all of that was back in undergrad doing a foaling class and taking my equine science class. And what my professor always said was, horses would give birth just fine if we just threw them out in a field, didn't look at them, and let them do whatever they wanted to. And they'd come back with all the babies.
Yes.
But we're too anxious about it, which I get anxious about it. I get sad if I can't see them on my camera. But like, yeah, we do a lot of things for horses that make us feel better, but are not ideal for them. So yeah, I would concur with that that answer for sure.
Awesome. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight. We've covered a lot, and I hope our listeners have learned as much as I have. Thank you, Dr. Fedorka and Dr. Ward, for joining me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to EquiThrive for sponsoring this event. Finally, thank you to our audience for listening and sending in these questions. If you're listening to us after the live event as a podcast episode, please rate, review, subscribe, and recommend Ask the Horse Live to a friend. Until next time, from everyone at The Horse, have a great night.